Well, very nearly anyway. We're going to talk about education of naval architects. So we've talked before about using wargaming to teach people to do things and to plan things and to make decisions. We've been using wargaming to teach people how to design equipment, which is one step further removed, and it leads us down some interesting paths, which I'm not used to seeing talked about before. I'm Nick Bradbeer. I'm the Naval Architecture Lecturer at UCL, just up the road. They warned me about coming here, the arch rivals, but as long as no one steals my head and uses it for a football, I'll count it as a win. My co-author is David Manley, who is the head of the ships section at the Naval Authority Group, and my parent organisation, who has supported these efforts and acted as a patron for us. So UCL has this very small naval architecture section, which teaches ship design and submarine design. We teach a master's course in naval architecture, a master's course in marine engineering, and we teach a short course in submarine design. We're quite heavily supported by the Ministry of Defence. Both Professor Savage, who I work for, and myself are MOD employees, embedded in the university, and we do draw on a lot of other university resources. A lot of our students come from naval backgrounds, Ministry of Defence, foreign navies, so we're quite interested in teaching warship and naval submarine design. That's a focus for us. There are other universities in the country which teach naval architecture, but none of them teach it with such a naval focus. But many of our students have come from somewhere where they've had very little or no naval domain experience. And when we make them design a ship, frequently a warship, we discovered this really shone through. Students were making really bad design decisions. We were getting escort corvettes with 8 surface-to-air missiles on them, which is a ludicrous number. They should have something like 30, maybe. But the students just didn't know. They didn't have any context. So they were making bad design decisions just because it's quite difficult for them to absorb that kind of information by being told it once when they have no background. So we started to look at better ways to teach them. We had three objectives. We wanted to teach domain context. So we want them to have that kind of understanding of what naval warfare is like. That means they can make better design decisions, which means they'll get more out of the design phases of the course. We wanted to give them an ability to assess military effectiveness of a ship design. That's really useful very early on in the process, because when they're working out what their ship should do, it lets them assess options quickly and make some sensible decisions. But it's also useful at the end, after they've spent 3 months designing a ship in their small groups. The ability to actually assess how good that ship is gives them a really helpful feedback. So that's the two main things. But also, both David and I come from a survivability background, particularly vulnerability reduction background. And that's something which we found very hard to teach understanding of. You can teach people processes, but it's not until they've actually seen a design and blown holes in it that they really get why it's a good idea or bad idea to do certain things. And it turned out there was just really good synergy with this process as well for teaching an understanding of survivability. So we started off by making some quite simple operations analysis tools to try and teach this stuff. Tools where you could put a set of requirements in and get some kind of metric of goodness back out. But the modern naval context is so heavily dependent on asymmetric information that those didn't really work without having an adversarial element in it. We're trying to teach interplay of numbers, ranges, speeds, weapon effectiveness, and so on. But we're also trying to teach the importance of reconnaissance, target location, identification, being able to bluff the enemy, emission control, that sort of thing. And that needed an adversarial approach, where you had two players with different information trying to achieve different things. So that just drove us to wargaming. So we did sit down at the beginning and think what we needed this game to do. Because actually, what we're trying to teach them doesn't really fit with the normal objective of a war game. We're not particularly trying to simulate a conflict accurately. We're not trying to teach tactical decision making, really. What we're trying to do is capture the impact of the design decisions which they make when they're designing the ship. And we're trying to engage them. These are students. I mean, they do have to be here. But they're not war gamers. They're engineers. But most of them don't have any wargaming background. Most of them aren't particularly driven to find wargaming exciting, so we need to make it easy for them to pick it up. So we're trying to capture, at quite a high level of detail, decisions that they make in the design process. Things like what's where in the ship, how tall their mast is, how high their radar can go, where the machinery is, where the systems run, supplying chilled water and electricity go through the ship, how well subdivided their ship is to resist flooding, the damage control arrangements to resist smoke and fire, which is a ludicrous level of detail for any normal war game. We're not representing a ship as a set of hit points, firepower and mobility score. We've got to really, really put a lot of information in there. But there's a load of other stuff we just don't care about. We aren't producing weapons engineers, so we don't really care that much about defining weapons to a particularly high level of detail. I mean, this, for the purposes of what we did, an anti-ship missile is an anti-ship missile. There's only one kind. And then we abstracted out everything which didn't need to be in detail, because we wanted it to be fast. Still not very fast, but as fast as possible. We wanted it to be easy to pick up for people who aren't gamers. And we needed it to be fun enough that students would want to engage with it, because that way lies more learning. So we actually wound up doing three things. We are tight for time this morning. I was quite conscious I've smushed 2.5 presentations together to make this one. So what I'm going to do is talk mostly about the top approach, ASCW, which is the largest game we do. And I'll mention very quickly the other two games which we have used. So the first one, ASUW, A Simple UCL War Game. We realised that we didn't really have a suitable game. We couldn't find a suitable game out there, so I had to invent my own. And this is the largest game that we have. We take over a whole quite large classroom for this. And we mostly use this for our annual event Tactics Night, where we bribe students with beer and pizza to come in after classes at the end of their ship design exercise, which lets them put the designs that they've produced to use and see how they do. So we take over a classroom. It's got a blue carpet, so that's handy. And we have a sort of roughly 3 by 4 meter operating space. We print 3D print miniatures of their ships, and we give them an operational plan. So it's a triple blind game, because information is important. Most of the students will be blue force. We have an adversary force, red force, who are behind a screen at the other end of the classroom. And then we normally get a PhD student to be white force and drive merchant traffic around the area. We found that really, really adds to the game, because it forces them to identify targets carefully, lest they do something really bad. Every player normally controls one ship or a small group of aircraft. Blue play on the floor, red and white play on maps. Now, the game is rules-based for movement, for detection, and for weapons effects. That's important. There's no adjudication in there, because that allows consistency. They are making engineering decisions, and they are getting a consistent response to those decisions. We do have some adjudication elements involved, largely for political complications. We like to have Twitter or newspaper headline injects coming through the evening. Occasionally, we'll need third-party neutral countries to express an opinion or launch a TLAM strike to make a point. But that's the only element in which adjudication comes in. So each ship has one of these control sheets, which, as you can see, is quite complicated. But this is how we capture all that detail. The students have produced a general arrangement drawing of their ship, so I can take that and we can convert it into one of these. You can see various bits of equipment are located, you can see the engine rooms are located, and we've got the systems runs and red lines. So you might have a system that's intact, but if you've blown up all the ways that electricity and chilled water can get to it, it stops working. So it punishes people for making bad design decisions. And there's a whole bunch of charts on there for speed, power, weapons, and so forth. When ships get hit, locations get knocked out, damaging equipment, and so on. And eventually, if the ship takes too much underwater damage for it to survive a flooding, it'll sink. If it has fires in all of its damage control zones, it's a mission kill. And this is basically how we do military vulnerability analysis of ships, this kind of approach, a much, much more simplified version. Movement is one of those things which we've basically just abstracted out. A ship can move a certain distance in a turn, depending on its top speed, and they just measure it. Aircraft are a bit simpler, again, because we're abstracting it out. A turn is an hour. Aircraft just fly out and back in one turn. It doesn't need to be more complicated than that, so it isn't. Detection is a little bit more complicated. We have quite a simple model. It's automatic. There's a detection radius. If the unit enters that detection radius, it gets detected. But what the detection radius is dependent on design decisions. So you've got how high your radar is. That pushes your radar horizon. And whether you've got your radar on or off. We have ESM, so electronic support measures, so you can hear other people's radars. So students rapidly get their head around the idea that it's a good idea to have their radars off so that the other side doesn't hear them coming. And then eventually they learn it's more complicated than that. So we have two maps. They get reconciled by umpires. We do the detection phase there. This is the most time-consuming part of the game, and it's something which we are looking to automate in future. We've tried some things. We've still not found anything better than an umpire looking at two maps and reconciling them. Air is really, really important. Initially, we tried without including air in the game, and it just does not reflect modern naval warfare. So we have a very simple air element. Aircraft can do missions. They can be reconnaissance, strike, land attack, anti-submarine. And basically, they just pick where they're going to fly, and they go do the mission, and they come back. They land on a maintenance track, which they step one space up every turn until they get to the auto box where they can launch again safely. They can launch early if they like, but they have a risk that the aircraft will fail at crash and won't be usable anymore. The numbers there probably aren't very realistic, but that doesn't really matter because we're teaching a concept there, the idea that you need more aircraft than you actually want if you want to be able to operate them continuously. Weapons fire is the sort of meaty part of the game. And we've got, again, quite a simple model. There is a gun combat model in there, but mostly weapons fire in these games is anti-ship missiles against a ship's defences. So it'll have defensive missiles, possibly close-in weapon systems, and decoys. We have quite a simple-looking model here. Well, I mean, maybe that doesn't look simple. It looks simple to me. Your defences just give you a number of salvos at various ranges. So as an incoming raid of anti-ship missiles reach 12 miles, we get to fire once. 6 miles, we get to fire again. 4 miles, we get to fire again. 2 miles, we get to fire again. This is the other side of the MCON trap. When students have learned that it's a good idea to turn their radars off so that the other guy can't see them coming, then they tend to drive around with their whole task force with their radars off. And then when someone else spots them and fires anti-ship missiles, they don't notice the anti-ship missiles until they're about 4 or 5 miles away from the task force, which means they've missed out on their first two salvo opportunities, and their defences are a lot less effective. They roll dice and see if they get shoot-downs and cross off ammunition as they go. The probabilities in here, and the ranges, the number of salvo, the PKs, are based on a more detailed model which we run offline beforehand, a time domain simulation. And that just populates this table, but it means the students don't have to worry about it. And this has been really, really good for teaching students about ammunition. They tended to produce ships which had not nearly enough missiles on board, and then they'll have a traumatic incident where they wind up with defeating a raid and having no missiles left in the tube. And that's the kind of learning experience you can't really replicate in a lecture, that adrenaline feeling of having made a bad decision. So the second approach we have is basically just that, but with less logistical overhead. ASCW on paper. It's basically the same rules, but instead of using a classroom, we just have paper maps, which is easier to reconcile, much lower setup time between games. So you'd think that they would be very comparable experiences, but we found that they aren't. It's faster to run, so on the face of it, much better for early stage exploration of multiple concepts. But it just does not engage students as much. It feels like work, I think. And you don't have miniatures that you're pushing around the floor. You don't have a large group collaborating on a task. And it works functionally. We get results out. And some students engage with it, the keen ones. But when we have tactics night, possibly it's the beer and pizza, but when we have tactics night, we get 80 to 90% of the students actually quite keen and involved, even if they don't have any outside interest. ASW on paper, maybe 30% of the students properly get involved. So I think that's one of the conclusions that I've taken away from this process. There is something in the physicality of the larger floor game. And finally, the other approach which we've looked at, which I could speak on for about 15 minutes, but I won't, one slide, is CROWS, which is computer software. So one of our experiences with ASUW was that reconciling detection and just cycling through turns when nothing was happening was what consumed all the time. And that seemed like a really easy thing to automate. So we did. I wrote some MATLAB code, because I'm an academic, so I write everything in MATLAB, which just controls maps. We have one computer, two players, each has a different screen. They can only see what their units can see. And we have a variable time turn length. So it just iterates through very, very short turns until the information changes for one player. So in theory, this seemed like a great idea. It automates detection. It automates all the movement stuff. And it's really, really quick. And we have used this quite effectively. But again, in the early stages of design, where we're letting people run through a bunch of options really quickly and assess how good they are. But again, we found that students just don't engage with it as much as with the floor game. It's efficient, and they can get information out of it. But they can make design decisions based on this, but actually it doesn't engage them in the same way. So overall, these are the three conclusions which I've drawn from this process. We really have seen an improvement in the quality of designs after we instituted this. Students make fewer stupid decisions when they design things. I mean, stupid is a harsh word to use because they didn't know any better, so it's unfair to think of them as a bad decision. But they are designing ships with better understanding of the domain, and that really shines through. Secondly, the physicality of the large game with the miniatures really, really does help to engage students. I don't know whether it's the large size, whether it's the miniatures, the physicality of it, but it clearly does. And finally, we've run Tactics Night 3 times now, and the last 2 years have ended in the students committing some kind of war crime. We have a way forward. UCL Faculty of Laws have offered me the services of some international law students who are going to inject into the command team as a "you can't do that, sir" person. We'll see how that goes, and maybe I'll report back to you on that next year. But thank you very much.
Great.